and is a senior advisor to the President for Native American Affairs at the University of Minnesota. In our conversation, Karen speaks about her rich background in leadership and advocacy work. She shares her insight on leveraging the unique strengths of tribal nations within higher education. Please enjoy our conversation from spring 2024.
I tell a lot of young people that are trying to advocate for themselves, I tell them the thing my mother said to me when I was young. If someone is doing something against your interests or trying to harm you, you don't speak up, you're helping them. You do not need permission to speak up for yourself from anybody. You can't count on other people to do it for you. You're the one in the room, you do it.
Bonjour, hello, welcome to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. I'm your host, Cole Primo.
And I'm your other host, Leah Lam. Miigwech for joining us. Native Lights is more than a podcast and radio show. At its core, it's a place for Native folks to tell their stories. Every week, we have captivating conversations with great guests from a bunch of different backgrounds. We're talking musicians, artists, community leaders, doctors, healthcare advocates, educators, language warriors.
Keep going.
You name it. We have a great group of people, wonderful mixture of passions. So we talk with our guests about their gifts and how they share those gifts with their community. And it all centers around the big point of purpose in our lives. And I can't wait to continue amplifying Native voices today. Cole, how are you?
I'm doing great. It's been a while since we've had a chat, so I'm greatly looking forward to it. Since we last had an episode, I have moved into the place in Stillwater, in the East Metro, but it's been, you know, a whirlwind and just getting everything set up, feeling like an official homeowner now, doing some mulching around the yard, doing some
there
grading,
you go.
Lawn mowing. I mowed the lawn not that long ago, and now it already needs to be mowed again, I guess. Mm-hmm. I guess that's just how it goes.
Were you wearing your cargo jean shorts and New Balance shoes? Some crew socks?
New Balance shoes that are just green.
I know.
They're just all greened up.
Got to embrace it.
Now, I do need to find some nice throwaway shoes, though, because mm-hmm. they get pretty dirty really quick. But how are you doing, Leah? What's going on?
Yeah, I'm doing great. Just hanging in there. I have, you know, my days are full of work and family, mm-hmm. and I like it that way. I don't have too much exciting going on. Oh, but you know what I am doing soon is I'm going to my 20th college reunion.
That's
here
right.
Very soon. 20 years. So I'm flying out to Boston.
Head back to New England.
And staying in Cambridge and just, I don't know, letting the memories fly back to me.
That's awesome. That's awesome. It's crazy it's been that long. I remember going out there, visiting you and all that stuff. It's a great city. Both Boston and Cambridge. And just, you also went to Berklee, of course, College of Music. And, you know, it's just awesome. Just taking, was it the T?
The T, yep. You don't need a car. Not like I had one anyway. Or my license, but we won't worry about that. But it's a perfect time of year. Ugh. So I look forward to that. So that's what I'm up to.
Nice. Well, that's kind of a good transition because you're talking about the university that you went to or the institute. And our guest is very much involved in a very prominent university in Minnesota. Today, we're speaking with Karen Diver. She is currently the senior advisor to the president for Native American Affairs at the University of Minnesota. Prior to that, she was the appointee of former President Obama as the special assistant to the president for Native American Affairs. So no big deal right there. We'll definitely make sure to ask her about that. And before that, she was the chairwoman of the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior Chippewa from 2007 to 2015. So yeah, I can't wait to talk to her about all the great work she's doing at the university, but also gain some insights from her previous roles and all that she's doing in Native country. So here she is.
Hi.
Bonjour.
Bonjour, Karen. Could you just start by, you know, introducing yourself?
Buju Anin, Karen Diver, and Indigenikaz. Karen Diver, citizen of the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa.
Great. How are you doing? How's the family doing?
Everybody's good. We're glad it's spring and looking forward to summer. Got to see the Northern Lights and...
Oh, really?
Yeah. And it's almost gardening season. So all of that is good.
Oh, yes. It's time to plan for the garden. Do you have a big garden?
I help my daughter with my formerly big garden at her house that used to be my house. She's learning to do vegetables and I'm pretty much just doing the pretty stuff anymore.
Excellent. Well, we like to start our conversations with something a little tangential to our lives, like if there is anything that's on the top of your mind lately.
Maybe the demise of democracy and how important it is for us all to vote and to get our families to vote and our friends. This point in time is an all hands on deck. This next election, presidential election, is an existential threat to everyone in the United States, but Indigenous people, because so much of our equities are grounded at the federal level. You can be angry about lots of things, but while you're waiting for perfect, it opens the door for harm. And so if we want to have structures in place where we can actually have some influence and things like that, then we need to make sure the federal apparatus is working. And then also pay attention down ballot, because there's this insidious movement at lots of levels to impact our rights. And so whether it's a school board or a county commission, pay attention and exercise your rights to vote.
Excellent. Yes, voting. I know a few people who choose not to vote, who say that there's not enough representation, but that's changing.
It is, but it's who we have, right? I mean, so either throw down and put your name on the ballot or find our allies. In the very worst case scenario, prevent harm. Thanks for letting me get that off my chest.
See, that's why we ask. That's why we ask.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we want to, you know, start off talking about your role that you currently have at the U of M, being the senior advisor to the president at the University of Minnesota. Like, what's the role like, and what are you setting out to accomplish?
I am a part of the president's senior leadership team in the office of the president. So I answer directly to the president. And I work with those senior leaders around tribal initiatives. I facilitate the communications between the office of the president and tribal leadership. And then, of course, you know, we had the truth report come out last spring, which was the tribal narrative history of the university from the tribal perspective, you know, kind of talking within the institution about, okay, this is our history. How do we then look at that and our past and create that better future? And the tribes gave us some guidance in the truth report, but it will all be, of course, informed by our really contemporary communications with tribal leaders about what feels right to them, what are their priorities, does this feel reparative, is it meeting your workforce development needs, where do you see gaps, what are your learners experiencing within the institution, and then we start working on things, and always in consultation with the tribes, are we getting it right? I'm trying to change them from within and make sure that tribal nations and Indigenous peoples find the University of Minnesota a place that serves their needs and is welcoming to them, that can remove barriers. I'm working with faculty. How do we have Indigenous pedagogy, so to speak? How do our learners see themselves within various disciplines? Do they see themselves? Where do we need to put extra effort? So faculty representation, staff representation, student support. I'm working on all of it.
You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and Ampers with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Today, we're revisiting our chat with Karen Diver. Karen is from the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior Chippewa and is the senior advisor to the president for Native American Affairs at the University of Minnesota. That's a lot. And you've been in the position, what, 3 years now?
Yeah, 3 years this month, yeah.
So just a few things.
Yeah, but we're getting some stuff done, though.
Yeah.
I mean, we got the tuition and fee waiver, and then the state picked it up the following year. It was such a great idea. So now the state is funding it. So we pivoted our resources towards housing scholarships for freshmen. The goal is to continue to invest in affordability until we meet the full cost of attendance. We are not there yet. Some of the detractors would say, you know, like, why aren't you doing the whole thing? Well, it's still a public institution with a budget it needs to follow that needs legislative appropriations that haven't been coming. So how do we make that slow and steady progress and keep taking bites out of the apple? And that's my job, right, is to keep pushing a little more. So we got that. This year, we put out guidance for ethical Indigenous research that requires tribal consent. Whoa, we have to actually ask. Yes. And no is no, right? And having data sovereignty agreements and behaving ethically and not extractive and exploitive. So that will be going for the guidance from my office now, but I've been going through the rather lengthy and involved process of making it official university policy. If that happens, we will be the first institution in the country to have as official policy Indigenous research guidelines. And might I point out, just in the nick of time, because 2 weeks ago, National Science Foundation put out guidance that said tribal consent will be necessary for any research proposals that come to them. So we are right on the money in terms of timeline and being well positioned. That's a huge thing, actually. So we're getting some good things done. You know, student support services are getting beefed up and funded and made more robust. We're engaging with American Indian advisory boards on the campus. So we're not just hearing from tribal leaders. We're also hearing from learners about campus climate, barriers. So we're kind of going bottom up and top down just to get more feedback. And then we're working with faculty to give them resources about some of the great Indigenous scholarship that's happening across the U.S. We've developed online library resources. So if they're in a particular discipline, they can go see what's out there from Indigenous scholars that might be new.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so this is the first time this position existed at the U.
Right.
How do you feel in that position? Does it feel like it's super welcoming, or has it been, you know, a little bit tough, or what's the atmosphere like?
I will actually tell you that I have been remarkably surprised at how incredibly gracious and supportive and receptive most people have been within the University of Minnesota. So I'm operating at that senior level. So I'm interacting with the chancellors, the deans. You know, when I tell them, I'm like, here's a problem I'm hearing about. Explain to me who, what, where I start to tackle this. And they're like, let me put you in touch with this person. And they'll weigh in. And many of these things, you know, I'm just telling them what the president's hearing from tribal leaders. And some of it's been organic on their part without me actually help. Now, I should probably preface all of this by saying I was actually really super pleasantly surprised. We did this fairly thorough inventory across the 5 campuses. And it was like 36 pages of Indigenous initiatives at some level. Now, mind you, some of them come and go. They might be grant driven. So it wasn't like we were not doing anything. I just don't think we kept track of what we were doing. And so that was a really good place to start with tribal leaders. It's like, hey, the glass isn't half empty. The glass is half full. You know, we have faculty and the colleges that have been engaged in your communities in really meaningful ways, you know? So how do we keep that going and make it more robust and understand that we can create these partnerships and leverage the knowledge creation that's happening? They recognize that there was a gap. It's bigger than just DEI, right? These are nations, these are governments. And so I did a 5-part online training for faculty and staff. It's like, okay, I can't train all of you, but here it is online. And people have been using it. They'll tell me, oh, I took your training. I know who you are, you know? And people are choosing to be a part of the work. And you really can't ask for more.
That's great. What can other universities learn from what the U of M is doing when it comes to building relationships with tribal nations?
Well, first and foremost, recognizing that they operate in concurrent jurisdictions, right? You know, the first thing out of my mouth with anybody, regardless of what I think they know or what they think they know, is tribes are governments. The reason we do this work is that, you know, your land acknowledgements are cute, but they're not enough. You know, this is about what you're going to do, but it's also about why you're going to do it. It's because of your interactions with tribe and your social license, right? Your permission. You know, we pay a lot of attention to lots of other jurisdictions, and it's the failure of the U.S. educational system that even people in Minnesota aren't taught about tribes and their history and their contemporary place in our communities, their jurisdictions, their authorities, the scope and breadth of the responsibility that tribal governments have, right? And from the university, we were specimens. You know, we were an interest group, and we have all of these poor social indicators and other things. And let's get to the root of that, you know? So trying to change that narrative from do to do with, and also the leveraging of the value that tribal communities bring, and that we're not just different, but there's a wealth of information there that's valuable to everybody, right? So example, these times of climate change right now, everybody's like, oh, you know, great, wise native person, tell us your traditional ecological knowledge, help save us from killing the planet, you know. Well, we don't trust them. We don't want to tell them nothing, because they used to come in our communities and not ask. And so teaching them about tribes as governments, it's like, do you have a tribal consent? Do you have a tribal advisory board? What is your data agreements? Just because there's something to be learned, we want to control the dissemination and the narrative and the word choice. We want to tell our stories the way we want. And while it might be beneficial, you know, how do we package that in a way that continues to be safe and it doesn't become commodified or otherwise misused, right? And that's all about respecting tribal sovereignty. So, you know, it's a different way of thinking. And this is probably the most difficult part for me in a mainstream institution. And this is true with the federal government or the university, is we come to the work with a vastly different set of values. Mine are informed by my indigeneity, clearly. Western-based or majority culture values, they're just different, right? And they celebrate different things. They think success is different things. And so reframing the narrative around matching our work as an institution to be compliant with the values that are present in Indian country or a particular community, that takes work and commitment on both sides. And if you're not willing to do that, then you don't deserve to be in partnership, right? Because it's not. You're exercising power then, and there is no place for you here.
That's awesome. We'd be remiss not to bring up your role before your work at the University of Minnesota as the appointee of President Obama, former President Obama, as the special assistant to the president for Native American affairs. How the heck was that like?
So that was interesting. You know how work-life balance in Indian country? Nope, there was none of that. We did have good weekends, but I got there at 6 a.m. I didn't know at any given day when I would leave. They said that you will never know what your day will bring. And that was so true. I scheduled my day in about 10 to 15 minute increments. I was always leaving something early to already be late. The portfolio was 27 different federal agencies, which was a lot for the Domestic Policy Council, because they like have a division that's just for education. Well, that division, which had way more people than I did, they only had to deal with Department of Education and Health and Human Services because of Head Start. So they had two federal agencies. So I would get everything from like the Office of Management and Budget from any of these 27 agencies that was regulatory or policy to weigh in on. Hopefully I knew it was coming. Sometimes I didn't. And sometimes you would catch things. It's like, oh, no, you know, danger. This requires tribal consultation. So, you know, I would have to tell OMB, kill it. They have to do consultation. This is not ready to go. I will not sign off on it, and tribes will be pissed. So I was there for the last year and a half or so. And one of the questions I had for them before I went is like, is there enough stuff left to do? I'm not going to be a seat warmer. If I'm going to leave this, I need to know that there's meaningful work. And they actually said one of the reasons they really wanted a tribal leader is because of the gravitas that they could bring to get some of the really big stuff over the line. There was going to need to be a fairly concerted push. And it was actually less than, you know, like the 15 months or so, because they try not to do anything major within the last 4 to 6 months. You're just wrapping things up at that point and creating that succession plan. in theory, let's just say that, given who the next president was. So it was intense. It was intense. It was tiring. It was frustrating. Probably the only upside I had to all of it is I remember saying to them, I'm like, you don't get how this works. I work for tribes. I'm employed by the president. So once you understand where my priorities are, what are you going to do to me? It's my job to push you. What are you going to do? Send me home? Great. I miss everybody, you know, and I'll tell on you when I get there. So I was like totally chairwoman the heck out of that. They didn't know what hit them.
That's awesome. Did you get to meet Obama? What was he like?
You know, that is one of the smartest people I have ever met in my life. But he was also just so intellectually curious. If you were talking about something and you could really see that he kind of wasn't connecting some of the dots, it was my job to say something. It's like I did it nicely to him, you know. He didn't get full chairwoman. You know, it's like, well, with all due respect, Mr. President, have you thought about this or this? And he would actually sit for a minute and take it in and change his mind. To me, that's the sign of leadership and wanting to do the right thing, being a public servant in the very best possible way, that we're not going to decide for you. Do you know what I mean? That we're going to look for those solutions that we think work. And I admired his values and consider myself really lucky to have been a part of it.
You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and Ampers with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Today, we're revisiting our chat with Karen Diver. Karen is from the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior Chippewa and is the senior advisor to the president for Native American Affairs at the University of Minnesota.
Obviously, you're super passionate about all that you do. Like, what led you down the path that you're on? Like, what sparked that initial passion for working for the community and all that good stuff?
So I was a relocation kid. You know, both of my parents are Fond du Lac enrollees, and with a lot of the same stories from that generation. Dad was a boarding school kid, got taken away when he was 6. His little brother was 5. He felt responsible for him. And mom, big families, no money, chemical dependency, family violence. My parents chose to go away on relocation partly because financial. Nobody would hire natives up here, you know, in Cloquet, Duluth, for good regular jobs, day labor, yeah, but not jobs that would take care of families. So my dad felt that pressure, but also just for opportunities. They wanted to go far enough away where they wouldn't come home every weekend and not try to make it work, but close enough to get back to within a day if they needed to, because this was home. So they chose Cleveland, Ohio. So the gift that my parents gave me was they never owned a home. They never had a new car. They put all 4 of their children through 12 years of private school. And we heard constantly that education is something they can't take from you. Education is the key to your own self-sufficiency and your own self-determination. And they made a conscious choice, despite how they were raised, to be the place where a lot of it stopped. They're my heroes. They were my best friends. I felt a sense of obligation from that. Do you know what I mean? They didn't tell me I was obligated to them. That was just love. But I was just like, I felt like I owed them to do my best. And then I screwed it up when I was 15. I had a baby. And it was like, okay, now I really got to make it right. And so I knew I had to go to college. And so I moved up here to go to UMD to access Minnesota Chippewa Tribe scholarship money. I went where the money was and became the first to graduate from school. But then I'm looking around UMD and I was an economics major, which is different for, you know, not a lot of us running around in the industry. Some, but not a lot. Everywhere I would look, whether it was UMD or around the community, you just didn't really see people going out of their way to be not just inclusive, but reparative. You know, like all of the things that I was struggling with as a young single mom, all of those barriers that were put into place where they didn't want you to come out of poverty. They didn't want you to be successful. They didn't want, and you know what? I'll just admit it. It pissed me off. So my whole career has been revenge. No, I'm just kidding. No, it hasn't been revenge, but I made it through for, I don't know why, you know what I mean? A part of it's being stubborn and not letting other people decide for me what my life is going to turn out like. And so then there's this part of me that says, with leadership, with responsibility, you have some obligation to make it a little better, right? So I ran the YWCA in Duluth for 12 years. It's a women's empowerment, social justice group, you know, so worked on those things and was representative in space where policy was being made and program development and advocacy and, you know, bringing up youth, you know, mostly Native youth in the hillside of Duluth, you know what I mean? And Native women, but all low income, nearly all people of color, quality early childhood education. So from that started learning, like, just kind of the pieces of advocacy and community development and public policy and power and regulation and how society kind of conflates itself and bakes these things in. So I became interested in government and how to affect it. So then I went to grad school. I got a master's in public administration from the Kennedy School at Harvard with a Bush Fellowship, a Bush Leadership Fellowship. It's like, okay, well, I need to credential myself to have that gravitas within the systems, right? You're playing their game. And so I soaked it all up and then came back and started working for the Res, and then eventually I ran for office, and that gets you all up to speed.
Absolutely love it. But yeah, thank you so much for your time. We'd like to ask, you know, as we close out, just if you had any final thoughts that you'd like to share with us.
I guess I'll maybe recap a bit. You're your best advocate. You don't have to apologize for it. You can take whatever space you need. Education really is the key to your own personal self-determination. You might not be so unhappy with your tribal government and, you know, your mainstream government and all of these external players if you can create your own solutions and financial stability and the ability to care for your family really does free you up to look at your citizenship in a different way. And then the last one is, you know, don't complain how things are going, whether it's in our own communities or wider communities. Citizenship comes with not only rights, but also responsibilities. And as Indigenous people, we have never had the latitude to only take the upside without the downside. And your citizenship is no different.
Karen Diver, legendary.
Awesome. Yeah. I love that. The fearlessness of advocacy and just, you know.
Take up space.
Yeah. Take up space. Don't be apologetic for it. Just, you got to do it. Love it.
Oh.
So yes, miigwech to Karen Diver. She is the inaugural senior advisor to the President for Native American Affairs at the University of Minnesota. She's also a former chairwoman of Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. I'm Cole Primo.
And I'm Leah Lam. Miigwech for listening.
Gigawabamin.
Gigawabamin. You're listening to Native Lights, where Indigenous voices shine. Native Lights is produced by Minnesota Native News and AMPRS with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
You know, that kind of sounds like spring is coming, not exactly like right now where their birds are going away a little bit. Charlie, what's up?
I did throw in a recording from May just because, you know, the sun is setting early. Things seem kind of dark out there. And sometimes you just need to hear a little bit of springtime. Bring her back up.
Yeah. I don't know what's going on with me. You're listening to the Season Watch podcast. Thank you for being with us. That's Charlie Mitchell.
That's Heidi Holden.
And we're here connecting you to nature and all the things that are happening. And even if you're someone like Charlie who needs to think about spring right now, gray skies, because November is the cloudiest month out there. For some reason, I'm embracing this sort of less light sort of thing and all the cool things that are happening. So there we go. We got a lot to talk about this week. I'm very excited about it.
Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of good things about the sun setting earlier. We get to see more critters. So a lot of our Minnesota critters like to be out at dawn and dusk. They are crepuscular. And now that, you know, the sunset and sunrise are closer together, we're out more during dawn and dusk. So we're more likely to see things. And we get to see the Northern Lights.
Yeah, we've got more on that later. What a cool thing. I do want to say thank you to the folks who are listening. Deer hunting season's still going on, and there were people listening from the deer stand to the Season Watch pod. We love that. And one thing we would love would be for you to record some sound and send it our way from the deer stand, because maybe they didn't get their deer last week.
Yes, please. I would love that. One of the things that I like am very envious about of, because I don't hunt yet, is that it's just such a great excuse to sit outside quietly in the forest.
Yeah.
Same thing with fishing. Another great reason to sit outside quietly.
Mm-hmm, for
Watch
sure.
what's happening.
So, you know, this time of the month is when we get a chance on the KXC Morning Show to talk to Pam Perry, one of our favorites. And she was talking about so many different things. About one of the things I loved and got worried about myself was one of your favorite things, the tree frogs, and how a couple had gotten in her house because she brought her house plants back in. She could hear the sound. She didn't know where they were, and she's trying to figure that out because she doesn't want them to die. You know, she's got to figure out how to get them back out there so they can find their leaf piles and put on the antifreeze in their body.
Yeah, because, I mean, that kind of dormancy is really important. It's like a animal's version of power-saving mode, or like, you know, that we low power mode that we have on our phones. And yeah, if they're inside, they might be awake and looking healthier than a frogsicle looks when it's frozen solid in the leaf litter. That's valuable energy that they're using up, and they really need that time of sleep, just like we all do.
Yeah, we're watching the seasons. It's Season Watch Pod, a production of KEXC, and I like the idea of we're heading into the season of sort of low power.
Yeah.
But Pam also really wanted to talk about cranes.
Yes, sandhill cranes. Beautiful animals.
I love cranes. And I know you don't see as many in the forested areas, the Northeast, as we do in this area, which I consider more central Minnesota. But last Friday, a friend of mine called me and he said, Pam, he's from Crosby. He said, I had to go to Aiken, and he's a birder. So any trip out anywhere, you always go check something. And he went up County Road 1 north of Aiken. He said, there were 300 cranes in the field up there.
Oh, my word.
He said, they're staging. So that was Friday. And staging means they're gathering from small groups, family groups, into bigger groups. And then they're going to head south, and they will figure out, and they'll go in a big, you know, big flock heading out. And of course they gather at Crane Meadows, south of Little Falls, Crane Meadows National Wildlife Refuge, and then Sherburn National Wildlife Refuge further south is known for large numbers of cranes. So many people go and visit there just to see the cranes and see that many at a time. So I was thinking about that, and that was Friday. And then we had cold weather over the weekend.
I noticed.
and a little snow. And I thought, I bet they left. And so where do they go? A lot of cranes winter in Florida, Texas, some in the other southern states where there's appropriate, suitable habitat, which is wet prairie, marshes with vegetation, you know, where they can find food and do that. I just think sandhill cranes are really cool. Everyone knows what they look like. They're grayish. They have some red on the top of their heads. They're 3 to 4 feet tall. They'll live 20 to 35 years.
Wow.
Long time. I know where they nest around this area, just south of Brainerd, over to the east. I see cranes all summer long, spring, summer, into the fall, and then now I think they're gone.
Everyone knows what a sandhill crane looks like.
I know. But I love that she gave us some ideas of where to go if we want to see these big cranes, because paying attention to this change in seasons.
Absolutely. And my wife heard one today.
Oh.
And I think that's generally true, even if you don't necessarily see the cranes, if you don't know how to identify a crane, you will definitely hear them during migration season. And they have just a spectacular dinosaur-like call, which I think is very fun, because they are also a very ancient group of birds, evolutionarily speaking. And so the fact that they sound like a dinosaur just lines up perfectly for me. But yeah, they're such cool birds.
Did you know that they live that long?
I think she said 25 to 35 years. Yeah, I didn't know that. That's spectacularly long-lived bird.
Yeah, for sure. Uh-huh. I mean, I guess that's something I am curious about, right? Where, how long do other birds, you know, I don't know that. Well, mm-hmm. maybe that's something we'll take up at another time.
Yeah, I know one of the resources that I often use when I'm looking up bird facts is the Cornell Lab of Ornithology's website. It's called All About Birds, no spaces, allaboutbirds.org. And they, for every species, have average lifespan or the oldest recorded bird as part of their like fun facts. Mm. So that's always fascinating for me.
We've been honing in on a Wilson snipe down on our shoreline that we're watching. That is digging.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, that is digging for the invertebrates is what I learned on Merlin and what it's doing down there, but with the really long bill. And that's been really fun for us this season or this last week or so.
That's really cool. Apparently a bunch of those shorebirds, their bill is actually like they can move the tip of it a little bit, like up and down, not just like a little finger.
Right. It looks like a, not a bill, but it looks like it's a tool for them, right?
Yeah.
Like it's doing the work. I mean, I guess I don't know. It's just so much longer than you're used to seeing and also vaguely prehistoric to me.
Yes. Yeah. But like, I always see like a bird beak or a bird bill as something like hard and that you wouldn't be able to change the shape of. And so it blew my mind a little bit. How do you move? I still don't really understand because a bill is made out of keratin, the same stuff that our fingernails are made out of. And so how do you change the shape of keratin? Anyways, I'm fine geeking out.
Are you? Okay.
A little bit.
Do we know for sure that every bill is made of keratin? I mean, what if it's made of something else on the Wilson snipe? I don't know.
Oh, Heidi, this is going to be a whole new curiosity deep dive for me that I'm going to embark on.
Is it like the cartilage you talked about last week with jumping in the pile and of the leaf pile? I mean, I know that's probably, this is non-scientific me, but just posing some more curiosity. What did you call it? The curiosity helix? No, what did you call it?
Hydra. You could chop off one head and five more grow
up. Exactly. We just opened up about seven more. So that's always fun.
Yep. Absolutely.
So
an internal bony structure covered by a, made out of bone, covered by a hard, shiny outer layer of keratin. But in some species, the keratin can be soft and leathery.
Ah.
And that seems like something that you would be able to flex up and down.
Sure. Interesting stuff. So.
Okay, more on this next week when inevitably Google.
So. We were thrilled this week because we got a message on SpeakPipe. Let's take a listen.
Yeah.
Hi, Charlie and Heidi. Love the podcast. Thank you so much for putting this out there. And I'm wondering if I can open up another question here for you. I am wondering about peak color. It seems around Stillwater here, we've had peak color ending around October 28th or 29th, pretty close to Halloween for the past 5 years, from 21 until 2025. But the preceding 7 years, from 2014 to 2020, we had dates where the peak color was ending October 20th or 21. So a full 8 days earlier for those 7 years. So I'm just wondering if you see anything in your data or in John Latimer's data, or if there's something else that's been happening for the past 5 years that's very different from those preceding seven, or just a wondering. Thanks so much for being there.
Well, now you're the head of data on this podcast. What do you know? Who'd you find it out from, Charlie?
So what I found out from was from John Latimer. He has a lot of his data available through the University of Minnesota's SeasonWatch website. It's seasonwatch.umn.edu if you want to go check it out. And so I was looking at some of his data there, and then he also sent me his updated data, including 2025. And for the red maple, for instance, you have all of these different dates scattered across a graph, and it's definitely trending later and later each year by about 6 days. But one of the things that I really noticed about the graph was in the years of like 1985 through 2015 or so, trying to think of the way to say this that isn't unnecessarily confusing. So you have the average, right? And you have variations from the average. So you were 5 days later than average 1 year and like 4 days earlier than average the next year. They all kind of vary around a normal point. Once you get into those later years of 2015 through 2025, the amount that like a year might vary from that average gets a lot wider. So instead of being off by like 3 or 4 days, it becomes off by 8 or 9 days, plus or minus. Yeah, as time goes on, it seems like we have a lot more really early or really late than we used to. And yeah, also, generally speaking, the average is getting later by about 6 days in John's data, 8 or 9 in Josh's from Stillwater. So that's considerable.
Yes, it is. And that's showing that there is change out there. The climate is changing. It's affecting lots of different things. We're watching on this Season Watch Nature Nerds Unite podcast here. We're watching what's happening out there. And smart person there calling in to us from Stillwater area. Josh, thank you for that.
And Josh is one of the educators at the Bellwin, I think it's Environmental Science Center, but I could have that wrong. Bellwin near Afton. And he's one of the other instructors for the Phenology in Minnesota Schools program, which is how I know him. But yeah, great, great educator and clearly has been keeping a lot of data. So thank you.
More changes as we're heading into the low power wintry sort of season. One of the things Latimer talked about this week kind of piqued your interest.
Yeah, he was talking, so I was already kind of primed for this from Josh's voice memo. John was talking a little bit about first snow and how that's changed over the years he's been watching nature.
We had snow on Friday night, Saturday, and I measured it at about 0.5 inch, and it melted out to about 0.02 inch of moisture, but there was snow cover on the ground. Pretty much universal at my house. And this probably, I think the snow staying on the ground, snow falling and remaining, the average date for that is the 11th of November. And that date is, by the way, getting pushed back. That is Bob Consemius and I have sort of compared notes. And in the recent years, that is early December now before we really get first accumulations of snow that then remain on the ground. First quarter inch accumulation of snow averages October 5th. This year, not until November 7th or 8th.
That's quite a difference.
Right? About a month difference for your first snow from October 5th being the average to November 7th this year. That's considerable. And when he's talking about, you know, the first snow that hits the ground and sticks, he said that was from the average used to be about November 11th and has transitioned to early December. So that's another considerable shift.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. That's why we dig into it. More and more questions all the time.
It's so complex. And I'm glad my job is just to say, hey, look at that. That's cool.
Here's what it might be. And let's think more about it. We're curious folks. That's what this is all about.
Mm-hmm.
What could be better than listening to the voice of students who have even more curiosity than we do? This week, we've chosen our friends from the North Shore Community School near Duluth.
Yes. They taught me a little something this week. I'm excited about it.
My name is Violet, and I'm your phenologist for this week. On Wednesday night, November 5th, Miss Urban was about to go to bed when she looked outside and saw the northern lights. On Monday, November 3rd, Miss Urban noticed lots of migrating raptors at school, including bald eagles, rough-legged hawks, and red-tailed hawks. The wind was very strong, so the raptors were probably taking advantage of the good migration conditions. The preschoolers were exploring on Tuesday, November 4th, and found 2 lobster mushrooms. The mushrooms were not attached to the ground. Perhaps a little animal picked them to eat as a snack. The preschoolers also found a pill bug, which isn't even an insect. It's a crustacean, which means it's closely related to lobsters or shrimp. This concludes the phenology report. Have a great week and be observant.
That part where pill bugs are crustaceans blew my tiny mind. I had no idea. So we always think of crustaceans as ocean dwelling, or at least water dwelling.
Right, and delicious dipped in butter.
I'm not a huge shellfish fan, so okay. You're going to be alone on that one. That's what people say. But yeah, that was fascinating to me. And so I had to look it up, and sure enough, they're right. And I also found a list of some of the common names for a pill bug, also known as a roly-poly, a woodlouse, a doodle bug, a cellar bug, I can't say that one on air, a bench biter, a chucky pig, a potato bug, cement bug, and then a little soil pig. In Italy, it's called a porcolino di terra.
Wow.
And that just brings me joy.
Something new we learned. Yeah, I've heard a couple of those. The doodle bug, that one? And potato bug. I've heard like on past phenologies too of talking about them. But that just shows us, and these are preschoolers.
Yeah.
Preschoolers who are questioning a bug and thinking it's maybe not a bug. Something else. I remember, this is going into sort of more of my own territory of letting more story and imagination when it comes to the outdoors, which I think is, we can do either or both. But I remember being with a little cousin of mine who asked me very, very seriously if bugs think that we're people or do they think that we're big bugs? Was the question posed.
I love that question.
Uh-huh.
There are so many different parts to that.
I know. I was blown away. I mean, maybe 4 years old when he told me that.
Yeah.
Maybe three. Honestly, it was crazy. So that's one to just ponder over and, you know, write me an essay and get back to me on that one, Charlie.
Maybe I will. I mean, the first question to answer is, do bugs think?
Yeah, yeah.
And then is, what is thinking?
Mm-hmm.
And, okay. Next week, we'll be talking about cognition in arthropods. Also, my new band name.
Yes, there we go. We've got a band name coming up for you from Tornado Bob, too, by the way.
Great.
But again, we want to tell you about that. We work with classrooms all around the state of Minnesota, and we broadcast their reports. And if you're curious more about what students are honing in on, those are also available at KXC's website, kxc.org. But we're choosing one each week on the Season Watch pods. You get a feel for it, and I think there's nothing more inspiring than, and it doesn't have to be a kid, but someone saying, take a look. Let's look closer. What is this? And just even the story of it all, of like that the teacher was about to go to bed when she looked outside and saw the northern lights. They're seeing their teachers as real people there, unlike me when I was freaked out when I would run into a teacher at the grocery store and I didn't know they lived outside the classroom, you know.
Right?
Didn't understand that.
Like, I think that would have been, I had kind of the same experience where my teachers existed in the classroom, and like, in sixth grade, I would have had a really hard time conceptually with like the idea that my teacher looked out their bedroom window and saw the northern lights.
Yeah.
Like, you exist after 3 p.m. You have a house.
You're not just there for
a window.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. But that's really important because that sort of became the theme of this week, the northern lights and the auroras. And, you know, we have a guy on each week, Tornado Bob. Certain times of the year.
Great name.
He's Aurora Bob, and he is always staying up, not always, but when he can, he stays up all night, drives to places where he can see the northern lights. But this week was a very different thing. But we talked to him a little bit on the KXC morning show about understanding these auroras out there.
Sun's been pretty active this week. This morning we had another X-class flare. And that has, we can see a big coronal mass ejection associated with that. So we've got a couple of these big flare-associated coronal mass ejections coming at Earth. The first is supposed to arrive this evening. The weather forecast is for cloudy, mostly cloudy, but clearing late. So by morning, it'll be clearing off. Tomorrow, it'll be mostly sunny. And then tomorrow night, it should be clear as well. So
okay.
We should have a good chance if the conditions with the magnetic field orientation within these clouds of plasma that are headed towards us, if the magnetic field orientation is favorable with a magnetic field that opposes Earth's magnetic field, then we'd see more northern lights. And it could be one of those relatively spectacular displays because we have multiple coronal mass ejections on the way.
All right.
So that was like kind of the same conditions that gave us our May 10th and 11th storm last year.
Mm-hmm.
That was a very remarkable one because I was looking south.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I recall now. Yeah, it was full sky.
Full sky. Yeah. And for a while, the northern sky was dark. And then the southern sky was, those were where the lights were.
Wow.
If it gets strong enough and the magnetic field in the solar wind is far enough south, then it'll push the auroras farther south too. Yeah. So they come closer to us, but if they, you know, this case, they went past us a little bit and they were down in southern Minnesota and Iowa.
Yeah.
So you look south to see the northern lights.
Aurora Bob there. Each week we seem to find a band that Charlie's going to helm. And of course, this week's is the coronal mass ejections. A little weird.
Ah, yes. The old CME. Coronal mass ejection. Oh, boy.
So I'm in northern Minnesota in Grand Rapids. Mm-hmm. You are in, what? How do you do, southeast? Not south exactly,
yeah, I'm
but
in,
south central, I don't know.
About 45 minutes north of the Twin Cities.
Okay,
so,
okay.
Southeastern, yep. And last night, when the northern lights were so bright, I was in the Twin Cities, and we could see, even with light pollution from the cities, we could see them by the naked eye, clearly. It was phenomenal.
And I found myself, because I always get mad if like I wake up in the morning and all of a sudden I see on social media, everybody saw the northern lights and I didn't realize it. So I texted friends. I texted people I don't know very well to tell them to go outside and look, because I went walking out, very mild temperatures. There's nothing like walking outside in your pajamas and watching the sky, man. I mean, fantastic. I just felt connected to people watching it.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was over at a friend's house last night and we knocked on their roommate's door, which we never do, to be like, hey, there are northern lights. You got to come see this. So their roommate came out and we were able to watch them. We saw a neighbor we sometimes see in their yard, but we certainly never talked to. And we were all oohing and aahing and taking pictures through the cameras and wondering why the camera looks so different from what our naked eye sees. It's the delight in nature that we talk about all the time, but it feels like everyone's just connected in this way of awe and wonder.
Well, and so many people saw it, and I was also using the phrase naked eye a lot because friends that were like only 2 miles away from me, and they're in town, I'm close to town, and so we have some light pollution, but I wasn't seeing the full-on reds. I was seeing more green, so I'm asking my friends, like, is that red? Did you see the red in the sky? Mm-hmm. And they're like, yeah, we could this time. You know, so this whole confusing thing of like, they're not very far away. And why are they seeing it differently than I'm seeing it? And then why this camera thing of how different it is?
I mean, talk about sparking curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that really does it. And, you know, I had a lot of those same questions because of who I am. I was looking it up. I did find some answers with the camera picking it up so differently than our naked eye does, which is such an odd idiom, naked eye.
Yeah, like, it is.
I don't need to be distracted by that now.
Except that I was wearing glasses, so is that a naked eye? I don't know.
Right? What kind of clothes do you put onto your eye? Contacts.
Yeah.
Okay. Charlie, focus. Cameras. Northern lights. Yes.
There we go.
Okay. The reason that our cameras pick it up so differently than our eyes do is because with technology being what it is now, our camera's sensitivity to light is now more sensitive, is able to pick up more light in dark situations than our eyes are able to. It also has the bonus of you can take pictures with a longer exposure. So it basically means that the camera's metaphorical eye remains open, gathering more light for longer. And we shockingly don't have that capability in our eyes. Our eyes have what is essentially converts to a frame rate of like 60 images per second, which is why a lot of times our movies and stuff are filmed at 60 frames per second. But so yeah, we don't have any control over our exposure length or our sensitivity to light. But our cameras do, and that's why we can see all of these different colors. I'm looking at my pictures from last night, and I saw a lot of red. And with my eyes, I could see a lot of red. I could see the greens that I saw on the camera looked more white and weren't as visible. And so I was curious about that, too. I found this great article on NASA.gov about how the different colors are formed, where essentially we have like all this energy coming from the coronal mass ejection. and when that hits the atoms in our atmosphere, like oxygen, nitrogen, so on, all that energy causes those atoms to glow. And so the way that it glows in different parts of our atmosphere creates different color. So if an oxygen atom is hit above 120 miles above the Earth, it causes red. And so those red colors are very, very high in the sky and therefore can be seen from further away. Blues and greens happen kind of mid-atmosphere. Nitrogen glows blue. Oxygen atom in like the 60 to 120 miles above the surface of the Earth range will grow green instead of red. And then below 60 miles, nitrogen molecules glow pink instead of blue.
Oh, boy.
And so all of those added together create all these different effects and kind of explain why, depending on where you are, you may be seeing different colors.
Wow.
What?
Sometimes I feel like when I see the photo, it's so different than what you see with, again, the naked eye, which I think that's a better band name for you, actually, the naked eyes,
okay,
than the coronal mass ejections. But, you know, that yeah, we'll put a poll up, I guess, maybe about something like mm-hmm. that. But sometimes I feel like it's a trick, right? Like that maybe that's not there, that the camera's just taking this picture this way. When I'm thinking about this wrong, it's not a trick. The camera, I mean, this whole thing of how we process color and how much we can see at one time and what's actually happening, it's no trick. It's
no, it's not.
Wow.
Yeah. And I mean, we use technology to heighten our senses
mm-hmm.
all the time, but we don't really think about it that way. And I think the way that we use it with the Northern Lights is just so much more obvious.
Hmm.
We're like, we use microphones to listen to stuff that we would never otherwise be able to hear. You know, even last week when we were talking about the game cameras,
yeah,
letting us see wildlife right. that we would otherwise never be able to see. Hmm. We live in a time where we are able to really expand our senses beyond ourselves.
Yeah.
And it's another way.
You know, you can't send a photo over the speak pipe or through a voice memo, but you can send us photos. You can email seasonwatch@kaxe.org. You can tell us the experience. Did you connect with different people because of the Northern Lights? Leave us a voice memo. Look for that speak pipe link at the podcast platforms or on our webpage. We want to let you know that this is a production of KEXE KBXE. We are the first rural community radio station in the nation, about to celebrate 50 years on the air and now digital. And we want to thank the Minnesota Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund for the funding for conversations like what you're hearing, and especially when it comes to students. Thanks also goes out, of course, to the members of KAXE.
The Wild River State Park, the soundscape we listened to at the beginning, was provided by Jonathan Jongsma through Zeno Canto, and the Sandhill Crane from that same recorder, also through Zeno Canto. So thank you, Jonathan Jongsma.
What do you want to leave us with today, Charlie?
You know, we were talking earlier about the Sandhill Cranes. Let's listen to that prehistoric sounding call.
That was Jim Miller doing Alligator Man at a 1978 Known Only Locally concert for KAXE. I'm Christy Miller, and I've been a member since 1977, and with husband Jim Miller, Gary Brusty, and Miriam Tell, Known Only Locally played many benefit concerts through the decades. I strongly urge you to donate to this people-powered radio station. We absolutely must keep KAXE, KBXE going. That's all there is to it. Text DONATE to 218-326-1234. Or go online to kaxe.org.
Thanks and good night.
Thank you. We'll see you at the Jack Pine Jamboree next Monday.